This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome to the final session of today's symposium, which I think has been a really interesting dialogue with lots of different approaches, lots of different types of objects and representations. And we're very lucky to have such four experienced and innovative historians here with us on the panel to give some further thoughts about the themes that have come up during the day. And so I thought that the way we might run it is I've asked each of the panel members to give a short, give them a short time opportunity to really tease out some other issues that have come up as well. So we'll just see how we go. So we'll start with Graham, and then after that we'll open up to questions from the floor and from other panel members as well.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Graham.
I have the sense, perhaps one or two of us in the room, John Mulvaney and I, of resuming a conversation that began a long time ago, because in the very early days of the National Museum, the possibility that that the collections of the museum might be used for historical research was one of the questions we debated, and I can remember long discussion about what might be the potential use of a national collection of milk cartons, I think was the example that we discussed. And people have found much better things to collect than milk cartons. And I think the answer to the question of whether museum objects can inform an understanding of history is best answered by example, and we've had some wonderful examples today. I think the quality of the case studies has really brought out both the diverse potential and the richness of working with museum objects. We've been asked, I think, to reflect a little on our own practice, and so I want to do that very briefly. One of the questions that's interested me throughout the day has been, what are the kinds of interpretive logic that we each apply to objects? And are there differences, for example, between the ways in which people in natural history or in archaeology use objects, where they seem to be somehow more intrinsic, compared with the way in which social historians use objects, which often seems to be much more contextual? And in that way, I was very sorry that I got here a little bit late this morning and I missed hearing Mike Smith's paper, but I've since had a chance to read it. And I think the framework that he provides in that paper was, to me, a very useful way of beginning to think about, where you'll recall he distinguishes between an understanding of objects through their provenance, thinking of objects as windows to discovery, objects as sources in themselves, and Mike, if I can add one further category, it's the discussion we had this morning about materiality itself, about the way in which we actually relate to the material world. They seem to me to be four of the things that we can learn about through objects. I want to just very briefly cite two areas in which I've worked myself. One, some of you will know, I wrote a book some years ago called The Unforgiving Minute, which was an attempt to write about time-telling in Australia, considered in almost its broadest way. And I was conscious, through work that I'd done before, of the way in which 19th, early 20th century Australian society was a society increasingly ruled by the clock. If you try to examine that subject, you don't actually find that people write in their diary, "This morning I got up and I consulted my watch." It's one of those silences in the written record, which in some ways is better understood, I discovered, by thinking about material objects and the ways in which, in the first instance, they're located in the landscape. So I spent a lot of time on that book, travelling the countryside, looking for clocks. My children began to object to this after a while. It seemed that every town we visited, I had to take photographs of public clocks. I had to try and figure out whether the sound of the clock could be heard from different distances. But what I was trying to do was to imagine myself into the world where the clock was a novel thing and where it was becoming an important part of everyday life. Years later, I had an opportunity to do something that amounts really to an object biography, when, with others, I worked on the history of the Powerhouse Museum, where, as many of you know, one of the most famous objects for a long period of history in the Powerhouse, the most famous object was the Strasbourg clock, the replica of the famous clock in the cathedral in Strasbourg that was made by humble Sydney working man, Richard Smith. And if you've come across that history of the Powerhouse, your museum, you'll know that I devote a whole chapter to the story of that clock, the secret life of the Strasbourg clock, I called it. And for me, it brought out all of the potential of being able to look at an object, the life of an object, and not only the process of it making it, not only the way in which it was taken up by the museum, but because Richard Smith remained the curator of that object, the mad curator, as he was really probably by the end of his life, it also enabled us to look at the way in which that object was actually situated in the history of that museum. Can I use one more example? More recently again, I was invited to write a chapter for a book on the history of domestic water consumption in Australia. This is a book mostly by social scientists who are interested in joining the argument about how our Australian cities should deal with their depleting water supplies. The suggestion was that there was something to be gained by trying to excavate the whole set of practices that we have for using water. And when I got into that subject, I very quickly discovered that, first of all, there are no statistics for water consumption in households back beyond early in this century. You have to reconstruct it. And what's more, you became aware that our practices of using water, particularly for bathing, are deeply connected with the ways we feel about our bodies, and not least about a subject that was talked about earlier in the day, which is body odour and smell. So I found myself having to try and reconstruct the history of Australian attitudes to smell and odours of the body. There's a wonderful story, if I ever have time to tell you. In about early 1960s, the Bulletin magazine published an article by Sidney Baker, who is a famous lexicographer, as some of you will know, in which he claimed that Ned Kelly was a homosexual. And in support of this contention, he cited two pieces of evidence. One was that he used perfume, and the other was that he danced with other men. Norman Lindsay, who by then was in his 90s, read this article and wrote an objecting. He said the reason he knew that he knew what Sidney Baker didn't know, that in the 19th century, men routinely used perfume. It was a simple way, in a time, different sanitary practices in which people put off what was otherwise the unpleasantness of having to meet with people in close quarters and deal with their body odour. So in search of this, I found that some of the best sources I could get were actually to go. I made my way back to the Powerhouse Museum, and thanks to Kimberly Weber, I not only consulted catalogues, but I was also able to reconstruct much of the technology of water use in 19th century society. In both instances, both in time telling and in water use, I think what we're trying to do in using museum objects is to fill what otherwise are great silences, matters in which we often don't get direct evidence. Those of you who are brought up, as I was, on R.G. Collingwood's The Idea of History, remember that one of his contentions is that what historians attempt to do is to think the thoughts of people in the past. What we're often seems to me doing also is trying to somehow re-experience in a fashion the sensory experience of people in the past, or at least to replicate it. Now, whether that's something that's possible to do, I don't know. I didn't ask the people at the Powerhouse Museum whether I could sit in their bath and whether I could find a piece of soap of that period and actually simulate it. But something like that, I think, is what we're attempting to do. So with that, I'll pass it to somebody.
Thanks,
else.
Graham. Paula.
Okay. It's been a wonderful day, and I'd venture to say that if we'd had more days like this of engagement and exchange between historians and curators and museum professionals, it would foster a much stronger sense of materiality amongst historians. I think it's been amply demonstrated, as if I needed convincing, that objects in museums' collections can contribute a large amount to our study of Australian history. However, I think from this morning's session you can see that the limitations are also manifest, and you can see if we have a day here where we don't have objects, it's even more difficult for historians to try and physically put objects in their narratives. But I think there's one more danger. I've listened to the stories about why we couldn't have the three dimensions here, and I am not convinced, I have to say. But because one of the... We are so much poorer for having only two-dimensional objects here today, and also what they do is reinforce the sensory regime of the dominance of the visual, as Maria made a point about this morning, and that in view of what Graham's saying, we need to be really attending to all the other senses in relation to material culture. And it's that very three-dimensional nature of objects that can help us do that. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that just as we've heard this morning about how material cultural studies has had a profound transformation in the last 20 years, I was a bit worried that in some ways some people were setting up a kind of straw historian. And so what I would like to say is that the discipline of history has also undergone a huge and very significant revolution in the last few years. So the questions about what is history and what's its purpose are being asked in very different ways by historians now. Now, what it actually involves is historians thinking about the legitimacy of history in different forms. So, for example, there's been a big claim from filmmakers about history being a legitimate form on film. You know, and the internet and the scholarship on producing histories on the internet is also now pushing into that question about what is history. It's not just a written account. It is any account in any kinds of forms where people are claiming the legitimacy of a history. So in that sense, the question of how historians might use objects can be a much wider, a much broader question, it seems to me. And the other issue that's related to the change and making history a more capacious concept is the question of audiences. Again, that was raised this morning. So the question of who historians are writing for has become a very big issue since novelists seem to be all writing the histories and doing it very well. So I think there's the question that somebody raised this morning about, are we just talking about academic historians here? Academic historians are only one form of historian. So what would be really interesting to do is to try and get popular historians to engage more with material culture as well, or people doing other forms of history. You know, how do you represent materiality through internet histories, for example, et cetera, et cetera. So the questions become much bigger in relation to history. Now, what someone else raised this morning was also the centrality of experience to historical work of late. And again, Graham's just referred to that. And the question of how people experienced objects, how they used them, but how they used them, what was their weight, you know, how they smelled, those sorts of things. What's the sounds they made? They're the kinds of questions that people are asking about what Graham's raised in relation to re-experiencing or re-enacting the past. I've got to rush through these. My other point is about memory. We heard from Fred this morning about... you gave a very good example of the way in which objects... are important carriers of meaning across generations. And what you revealed to us in the Native American context was that objects can carry meaning across generations, whether they're in museums or whether they're outside of museums. Now, I've only looked at their context. That was a very good example of the way in which it can even happen through, well, not even, but perhaps museums are a very important medium for connecting generations. So I think that along with history becoming a more capacious concept, we can consider the issues that are raised by memory. And what I mean by that, okay, so objects provide powerful connection across generations, but there are some really knotty issues, which we can't go into here, relating to remembering and forgetting that we could explore in relation to objects. So somebody again referred this morning to the way in which objects help you remember things you might otherwise have forgotten. They stimulate memory. But as Margaret also revealed, what kind of memory do we have? What kind of social memory? What kind of history do we have if we only have what survives materially? And as she very clearly revealed, there are limitations to material sources and in terms of how we can interpret them. And that leads me back to the question of the intangible. And I think that although some dimensions of humanity can't be understood without materiality, and some can, it raises the issue that has become very, very fashionable at the moment, which is the question of the intangible, or what Raymond Williams used to call structures of feeling. And I believe that objects can be a bridge between our mental and our physical worlds. But we need to be far more attendant to their multi-sensory dimensions. And by that, I don't mean, as I was discussing with people later, necessarily that you try and use smell and sound in exhibitions, often with disastrous results, as Peter said. What I mean is that we need to be thinking about our language and how we, the kind of subtle connections that you can make when you're thinking, as Graham's very aptly illustrated, about how things smelled, how things sounded, how they felt when you used them, and what the weight of them was. It would have, I think it enhances how we understand materiality a great deal more. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. It's been a really wonderful day, and I think we owe a lot to the National Museum, because I don't think at the moment, certainly speaking for my own museum, that there are very many museums around the country that could pull this off. So congratulations. And it's wonderful to see all the practitioners here in the National Museum actually focusing on objects. I wanted to talk a little bit about the book that was mentioned a couple of times this morning, Ochre and Rust, and how that reflects my practice as a curator. I've been at the museum in Adelaide for longer than I care to remember, 20-odd years, and having begun there in the early 80s, some of you may remember that computers didn't exist then, and that it was possible it was a necessity to look through old ink written leather-bound ledgers if you wanted to trace objects in collections. And one of my first jobs as a research officer was to do this, drawing out objects from the Lower Murray region in South Australia, and this necessitated reading the collection, 68,000 entries in the ethnographic registers in 11 volumes. The only way to extract the information was to read through every page and make a transcription in another register. And this proved to be the best thing that ever happened to me in the museum. And it is something which is denied all modern museum researchers. So I wanted to begin with that anecdote and talk about two risks, really, that lie in the area of the scrutiny or the interrogation of objects. And I think in certain ways some of those risks, or these two risks possibly in others, have risen to the surface today. One is the risk that objects may become ends in themselves, that it is wonderful to find one's favourite object and then to have it worry you to the extent that you do interrogate it and you end up waking up in the night and thinking about it and having breakfast with it, possibly, metaphorically. And you eventually lay it to rest, possibly by publishing it or exhibiting it. But there is a risk there, because the risk is that illumination, that process, that energy, that electricity that you generate may not actually transfer to knowledge, to lasting knowledge. It may simply just form its own little vortex and eventually close over and disappear. So that when I began Ochre and Rust, I'd already been through the 68,000 objects. I'd also written a PhD thesis on the ethnographic collectors, and in the South Australian Museum identified 3,200 ethnographic collectors across the Pacific and the Aboriginal collections, and homed in on the 2,200 collectors who were responsible for the Aboriginal collections, and boiled those down to about 300 who I thought was significant, and then begun a taxonomic exercise on those, dividing them into the various levels. And I think out of all that, certain objects had already caught my eye that couldn't be left alone. And it was those objects which eventually came to the surface in Ochre and Rust. But they did so not just because they were transcendent, luminous objects, but because I believed that learning about them would illuminate an area of Australian history which I could see at that time was being characterised in a certain way. And this was just before the history wars, in which we all witnessed a polarising, I think, of stereotypes relating to Europeans and Aboriginal people on the frontier. And we witnessed a stereotyping of the frontier itself as a hard and fast line which separated cultures. And I believed what I was seeing in these objects was a more complex and complicating set of factors, which was proving the frontier as an interactive and interlocking zone of problematics, not necessarily one that totally resulted in heroes and villains, but in which heroes became villains and villains became heroes. The objects themselves could act as witnesses. And I use this term, we've heard this term, biographies. A term I like, I think, a lot is an object as a witness. It's a witness through into a whole series of activities that have occurred in its own existence, but also more broadly. So this is what I mean is that these objects were selected because they had this capacity to illuminate a broader subject, and I think that as museum curators we have this duty to maybe resist the temptation of the alluring, luminous, transcendent object for its own in its own terms, but to find possibly more mundane, nondescript objects which can actually take us into an area of history which is either poorly understood or is being misunderstood. The second risk, I think, which Ochre and Rust was in a way represented an engagement with, was a risk which has emerged more and more in these few years, elapsing since beginning the project and the book's publication last year. And this is the risk of a diminished engagement with objects by curators. There's an extreme irony in this, because here we have this room full of people who are all engaging with objects one way or another, and I don't actually think we have to have objects in the room to do that. We have the power of our imaginations. And what the risk is that curators are more and more, I feel, disenfranchised from the collections in museums. This is occurring all across the country and all across the world, as far as I can see it. What has happened is that collection management has been professionalised. Access to collections is more regulated than it ever has been before. This is a very good thing in many ways. It preserves material, possibly for future generations, more so than the old regime. But it means that a curatorial oversight, the capacity for serendipity, such as one used to get in libraries that had books on shelves in stacks, and you could move through them and turn from one to another in the same way, moving from one wooden container that tells you something and then to another is a wonderful thing. And I think perhaps we have this risk now of losing this capacity. So that's something that Ochre and Rust, I guess, I benefited from not having this regime necessarily being imposed just at that time in history. And it would be wonderful if there was some way of bringing back those capacities for museum researchers to encounter collections without the hoops that they have to go through today. Do I have any more time? That's it. No? Okay.
I guess the advantage of going last is that you can... Because it'd be great, I think, if we had lots of time now for questions. I had a couple of things to say, which is most of the work that I've done around objects has been in relationship to place, and it's been very much about trying to write histories of conversations about people's different ways of remembering the past. And so Botany Bay was an important kind of site for being able to look at the materiality of historical remembrance in its kind of uneven balance between a kind of quite heavy materiality in the monumental form compared with, say, the local Aboriginal communities' efforts to have their histories preserved in material form while their occupation across place is quite long and genealogically long. And so I was interested in using material and objects to sort of draw out those discrepancies between kind of fleeting histories and long histories and the different materialities around those. But also particularly I've been really interested in today's discussion about where the object comes into your history, whether you start with it or you do it as a supplement or you do it at the end. And in a way, writing place histories, it's impossible not to use objects as a source along with the documentary, the ephemeral, the naming, commemorative performances. So I think objects in that sense are just so central. But also in tension with the sort of thing that Paula was saying about intangibility, always in tension with the tangible or the immaterial, and some of that has come out. I should just say I really enjoyed this morning's session for the different disciplines, and I think it's slightly a shame that you've ended up with four historians at the end of the day, because the anthropological approaches that Fred was talking about, the idea that objects are occasions for storytelling, and then in fact it's not really the biography from the beginning of from the cradle to the grave, but those moments in which they come back into circulation or they become occasions for storytelling, was incredibly important in that work on Botany Bay. I want to say something which is moving away from the idea that the object exists and you can write histories of it, to the idea about if we think about historical moments or events with objects central to the thinking. And I feel like I'm allowed to do this because Captain Cook has already been mentioned today, and the project that I'm working on at the moment is about Captain Cook. And I think you can't think about Captain Cook in Australia without thinking about objects, and in fact you can't think about him unless you think about his attitude to objects and to things. And he was using things as evidence. And in his distribution of trinkets, what he wanted to do was test ideas about people's attitudes to things, how they use them, trafficking in things. What's then interesting in this work, I think, is we look at Aboriginal stories after contact about Captain Cook, and he's remembered mostly as the man who gave things that Aboriginal people didn't necessarily want, or if they, or they did want them, so they made distinctions between. But he figures as a giver of things, and those sort of ideas about objects and how they are in these histories. If you think about these histories in with objects at the centre of your mind, thinking about how objects are structuring relationships and encounters and understandings after the event. The problem is that I don't think the museum's got any of those sorts of Captain Cook objects, which is a shame. So we don't get to tell histories about Captain Cook, which are fundamentally about what he thought he could do with things when he came to Australia. So that's my point about thinking about things in the absence of things. That's it.
I'd like to open it up to questions from there. So if anyone has any questions of some of the ideas that have been sort of raised by the panel or other issues from the day.
Maria, I found that point really interesting about the absence, because I guess having followed along the trail of object histories and what they give or don't give, I'm wondering about the absence of those at all and whether or not hierarchies can within that become created by how many objects surround a history. And perhaps in the case of, Iraq, where things like objects are lost, becomes a kind of another history about that loss of objects, and how do we start to talk about those histories when those objects are gone? I'm interested in where we go from here.
Mm-hmm. I think to some extent people are doing that all the time when they're talking about the objects that they've got. And I thought that came through in some of the presentations today, is that the objects start, you know, the existence of an object starts here, but all around there a whole series of lost objects as well. So there's not a kind of presence of objects and a kind of absence of objects, but those things are always are sort of around as people are trying to write histories. And so in the end, and people, this has been floating through, there is that kind of sense of contingency about what remains. But that can be used quite productively. Yeah. What's that? Sorry?
If there's no object, is there no history? I guess, is that the end point you might end up
with? Oh. Only if you're really committed to an idea of object history. Only at the point that you want to have an object for your history. There are so many books about sort of lost things, aren't there? Now it seems to be almost an obsession to write about absence and loss and
It does offer challenges to museum exhibitions. I remember that the Museum of Contemporary Religion in Edinburgh was faced with an issue where they had to, Edinburgh being a sort of town split half between Catholic and half between Presbyterian. The Church of Scotland came in, they destroyed a lot of all the Catholic icons and things. So they had actually no material culture of their own that was linked to very strongly with the Church of Scotland, but there was a really strong tradition of objects relating to the Catholic Church. And so you had this sort of imbalance of objects to draw upon to tell the history of those two. I can't remember how they actually resolved it, but it was a major curatorial issue.
Hi, this is just a comment, really, on a thought that's been running through my mind all day, but also generally in my association with the museum recently, and it was triggered by the last session's discussion about what do we do with materiality. I suppose the thing that worries me as a historian is that here is a great opportunity to actually grasp the material nature of an object, to understand, I suppose, is partly your point, Graham, how it's put together, how it functions, what it's made from. But so often it seems, even in our discussions today, it's this kind of tension between material histories. An object must tell a story. It becomes a kind of cipher for some narrative that we want to draw out of it. And I think the unfortunate thing about that is that we don't often pause to really dwell on the material nature of the object that we're looking at. We always jump to say, oh, well, what kind of story can this tell us? And I think partly from dealing with a lot with some postgraduate students recently, I'm finding that they're moving beyond increasingly texts to considering materials. They want to find ways of writing about materials, partly because they don't want to tell the seamless, breathless, one-dimensioned narrative, but they want to explore other ways of understanding history and history as it's believed in by communities. What struck me, I mean, there are lots of questions, there are lots of problems with the new Museum of Ethnology in Paris, Quai Branly, but what really struck me and has stayed with me since I was there was that they don't caption things as a description, full stop. They often caption things as a statement of its material quality and a question. Why did these people use dots or dot dashes as decoration? What does this suggest to you? Why would people have done that? And I think so often there is a scope in the way in which, as curators, but even as historians, we present material not to assume that our readers are going to want the resolved story, but maybe they're going to want a little bit of a prompt to, hey, what kind of question can you ask of this? Because I don't have the answer, and your perspective is going to be very interesting to me. And I think that's something we can really dwell on, to ask people to actually engage with the material rather than jump straight into the cipher of the story that it ought to represent.
I'll just... I agree completely. One of the projects that we're involved in the South Australian Museum is to do a provenancing project on, or a chemical fingerprinting project on red ochre. And Mike Smith has been one of the people who's inspired this idea through his work. But if that comes off and we do end up with a suite of diagnostic techniques for provenancing red ochre, we can suddenly draw lines between objects in the museum at different levels and linking them in ways that we've never been able to do before. So that to say that the ochre on this spear thrower comes from the mine that produced the ochre on this shield, which is actually belonging to another cultural group, for example. So I think to expose the logic of curatorial inquiry in the museum is the key thing, rather than just simply asking a question. I think if all those questions are pointing to, once again, another area of knowledge which has been unearthed, then maybe the public can form the view that the museum is actually pushing forward coherently, rather than just indiscriminately asking questions.
I'd love to add something to that. One of the great pleasures of bringing postgraduate researchers in history into the museum is, and having curators talk to them, is that all of a sudden they realise that there are exactly similar processes behind curatorial decisions that they undertook as textual researchers.
Right. Yeah.
And it was such a breath of fresh air to realise that there wasn't some kind of seamless full stop providencing that had gone into the object that they saw, but a lot of very intricate research-based questions that I would just encourage curators to really grab that opportunity to say, hey, look, the work that we do is research-based, it is interrogative, it is about asking questions rather than just finding the problems. Mm. Because people have that assumption about curatorial work, but it's just not true.
I suppose further to that, Nick, and also picking up on Paula's comments about widening a sense of historical accounts, it's useful to think about the technology of the exhibition in museums, and we've touched on it a couple of times today, but we haven't talked about it exhaustively, and the capacity that objects in that context and the relational qualities of objects in assemblages within exhibitions actually provide opportunities for different kinds of historical meanings to be to erupt, really. And in a sense, the discussion about more instrumentally thinking about objects as sources for history, as one might write, while not negating that opportunity or saying that that's not one that should be followed in terms of museum practice, perhaps it's the technology of the exhibition as an original historical account in that sense that provides some of the best opportunity for the museum as a theatre of objects, if you like, in some ways, to bring its perspective to bear in creating new historical understanding or new understandings of the past. And that seems to be... it's certainly a strong element of the work that's happening at this museum, and I think promises also a great deal in terms of engagement with audience and for audiences to understand their relationship to a past and understand some of the way that they are produced by the material world.
I couldn't agree with you more, Matt. I think it's a really important point. In fact, I would argue that museums have taken up quite a bit of the ground that's shifted in relation to historical authority, and that museums are taking up the ground of telling some of the important Australian stories, and that with a more capacious sense understanding of what we can do, that museums will increasingly become important. But I think we need much more engagement, much broader engagement with curators. Curators being out there more, I think. I'm not quite sure what the problem is, but
one of the questions, and I think this is one that colleagues here, Lena Hall was here earlier today, one of the curators at the museum, and I think was touching on this. She was asking a question about what's the meaning that's produced through relation of objects in an exhibition.
That's right.
And some of the senior curators that have been working in that team, and Kirsten Wayne, I don't think, is here now, asks a very strong question, I think, that's germane to this discussion about the lack of a kind of a language to properly explore the kinds of historical meaning that emerge in the three dimensions of a museum exhibition. Mm. And that the part of this issue is about trying to construct a way of speaking and talking about exhibitions that doesn't see them simply as translators, if you like, of ideas that are a priori, that have been generated outside the exhibition, but are actually produced in the context of the exhibition itself. And I think there's much in that, but there's that kind of a need for a more involved discussion about the kind of historical meaning that's possible in the context of an exhibition.
The comment I sort of want to make about that, because I can hear you sort of say, I can't think of an example, but you're saying assemblages and things put together in relationship. And yet the kind of model that people have talked about mostly today has been biographical. And that seems to be at odds, and I think someone else has already made this point, of that idea of bringing together sort of disparate objects and together in some way in terms of the relationships you want to draw between them, that they become to tell a new narrative, which goes back, I think, probably to the work around sort of James Clifford's work around thinking of different ways of writing, which might be more like montage and juxtaposition rather than linear narratives, which no matter how the new modern biographies are working, they work still linear thing. Now, I think Fred's right. If you get too far down that track, you become where you make no sense in a way. But it was the sort of stuff I tried to do at Botany Bay by bringing together, say, an 18th century picture of Timbray, which comes from a French expedition, which is in one museum, a breastplate of another Timbray, which is another family name, which is in the Australian Museum, and then a boomerang by a fellow with the surname Timbray to create a new kind of family history. But each of these objects belong in different museums to tell very, very different stories unrelated to the locality or to the family. And I think maybe you're not saying that exactly, but these assemblages, I think, are critical.
Clinton Johnston, I was just wondering whether you feel this scientific deconstruction of objects has a negative impact on the aesthetic and emotional qualities of these objects, or whether it creates an understanding of these objects that informs an appreciation of those qualities. Maybe past speakers.
Good question.
Well, I'll set the ball rolling. No, I think you can do both, and we do both. And that the more you know about the object, the more likelihood that the emotional story that you can draw out of them is going to be believed. I don't think there is an either-or. You know, it's really a combination, and the best biographies carry the reader emotionally, and similarly with an exhibition.
I'd only add that I think you clearly see in different exhibitions different weight given to the aestheticisation of objects. You know, there clearly are some exhibitions which, by the way in which the object is presented, encourage you simply to stand back in awe and not to interrogate. And then there is others that really demand much more of you. And I think part of the challenge in exhibitions is to find the means of enabling visitors to be able to engage in a variety of ways with objects. And there are different ways. I mean, for example, you know, I like the Pergam Museum because there's a minimum of labelling, but they now cleverly use the electronic interpretation to enable you to drill down to pretty much whatever level you want. So if you want only 10 seconds on that object, you can have 10 seconds. Or if you want to go on interrogating it, you could go and stand before that object for, it seems to me anyway, for half an hour and keep asking questions. Now, technology is not always the answer. But I do think we need both to find means of presenting objects, whether it's in an exhibition or in a catalogue or in a book or whatever, that cater for those different ways of approaching objects.
I'm just aware of the time, and I think we've got time for one more question or comment. So I think Fred.
It may be not a good ending point, but I'm just struck as we've come to the end of the day that there's been no discussion about photography, which photographs, which is a big part of the archive that many people consult, and I don't. And it's just really that we're kind of emphasizing so-called three-dimensional objects and ignoring another kind of object, which is very highly theorized and is very complex in terms of capacity to tell, reverse, invert stories, and so on, which I think is. I don't know what implications that has, but I think that just by accident, in a way, we just haven't gotten around to discussing some of those. Maybe that's another symposium.
Someone's written about, I forget it, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Edwards.
Elizabeth Edwards gives a fantastic paper about the, you know, the nature of photographs as material objects.
I take seriously that suggestion that it's a terrific topic for another symposium, and I think it would be, since those of us who are historians in Australia often access photographic collections these days through the National Library's catalogue, and it's in a way our first port of call is the object, and it's only afterwards that we actually begin to recognise its provenance and where it's located. So thanks to that wonderful tool, we are able to access a huge number of photographs, but we are not necessarily engaged in the first instance directly with their provenance or the curatorial practices that actually have brought them into being and govern them. So I think it would be wonderful if the National Museum, perhaps together with the National Library and other people, were to actually bring together a symposium on photographs and photographic collections and how we interpret them. It would be a fantastic thing to do.
Yeah, I think we might close it there. Thank you very much to the four panel members.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.